ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on tonight's program, I'm going to talk about a person who is larger than life. A very, very special person. A man named William Phipps. He was born in a very remote corner of one of the English colonies in North America, right? In Massachusetts, in the north, away from civilization, never learned how to read and write, but he was very special, larger than life, evidently very good looking, very attractive, tall, strong, never ill a day in his life. And he became the first, North American to be knighted. They made him a Sir. Sir William Phipps. And he became a treasure hunter. Ha ha! He found a treasure. And that's, you know, his big claim to fame, right? He was, among other things, he was considered a hero. And then he was very involved in politics, right? After the Restoration, after the Puritans were no longer popular in England, and the kingdom, the Stuart dynasty, had been restored, and King Charles II was now in power, it was going to be necessary to assert royal authority, especially in this area, Massachusetts, where Phipps was from, that was still a theocracy, that was still very much Puritan. If you think about, how the Taliban work, for example, try to imagine that as a Protestant theocracy in a colony that is supposed to be the city on the hill, right? This biblical reference that that Christians should be like a city on a hill, meaning baliza, a beacon, right? So that everybody can admire them and use them as a reference, a point of reference, a role model, right? Trying to show the rest of the world how to live. That's the way they self-consciously saw themselves. This is, as I say, a theocracy. Naturally, when the Puritans took over in England, some historians say that as many as one-third of the men of Massachusetts went back to England, or in many cases they'd never been there in their lives, but they went to England to fight on the side of the Puritans. Well, what's going to happen to a Puritan colony in a post-Puritan world? Which side are you on, William Phipps? Let me tell you, he is conflicted. But again, the most important thing about Phipps is that he was a treasure hunter and found an enormous treasure, a Spanish treasure, a treasure that was lost in the years of crisis, in the crisis of 1640, the crisis from which Spain really never recovered. And it was the beginning of the end, right? El Siglo de Oro, the century, the magnificent, the golden age of Spain, that's how we refer to it, La Edad de Oro. We call it the Golden Age of Spain, This is the eclipse beginning in 1640. Now, on my last program, I was talking a little bit about that. What happened when Louis the 13th of France declared war and Felipe IV, Philip the 4th of Spain, immediately saw that Catalonia was vulnerable, that it could be attacked at any moment. And the idea being, certainly the idea of the valido, of the Conde Duque de Olivares, his idea being that the best defense is a good offense. He had a proposal of arranging for an army of 40,000 men to attack France from Catalonia. And that at least, well, Catalonia would, in any case, have to support troops that they considered foreign, troops, non-Catalan troops, at least 6,000 of them. And laws, of course, enacted that they would have to be given quarters, cuartel, they would have to be given lodging, alojamiento, and food at the expense of the locals. And again, the locals hated this idea. All of this part of a larger idea called the Union of, well, Union de Armas, in which all parts of the Spanish Empire would defend each other and participate actively in the defense of every other part. That the Spanish Empire, instead of being multiple empires, occasionally working against each other, would suddenly all fight on the same team. Now, this was considered an intolerable abrogation of rights and rules. And again, where does it stop? Because El Conde Duque de Olivares needed money, and needed more money, and more money. And during the course of the 17th century, wars got infinitely more and more expensive. They were costing exponentially more to fund. Armies were simply money pits, right? Fosas para el dinero, pozos, money pits that you throw all of your gold and silver into that, and you never see any result. So yeah, Olivares said, if the constitutions get in the way, then the devil take the constitutions. This was his big quote. Si las constituciones embarazan, que lleve el diablo las constituciones. And that's the way he felt, and that's the way he acted. And people began to resent that. Certainly in Catalonia, in rural Catalonia, there was a constant fight between the troops and the locals who were supposed to be hosting the troops. If the troops didn't get what they wanted, they took it. And in many cases, they were in their rights to take it. And of course, this was not handled diplomatically. We'll put it that way. Finally, in 1640, during the during the festival of Corpus Christi, you had people coming from the countryside. Corpus Christi, traditionally a festival of people who harvest grain. Now, the old word for harvest is reap, R-E-A-P, to reap. And so, because this is, again, centuries ago, we don't use the word harvester, for example, the way you would today, but rather reaper. By the way, you see the image of death that we often use in the Anglo-American world, German world as well. The image of death, death is a man. We think of death as a man. It's very strange for us to think of death as a woman. And for Spanish speakers, almost impossible to think of death as a man. I saw death and he said, what do you mean he? You know, this is the Spanish reaction. He? Come on. Because in the Spanish mind, death is female. Well, in any case, you have seen this death usually, usually as a skeleton and holding a guadaña, holding a scythe. And, the name of this image is naturally because of the guadaña, the reaper, and, the grim reaper, el cosechador tétrico, the grim reaper. Now, the people I'm talking about who were in Barcelona in order to celebrate Corpus in June of 1640, also called by historians reapers. In this case, they do not have scythes, guadañas, but they do have a sickle, oath, right? The traditional symbol of communism, the hammer and sickle, oath y guadaña, digo, oath y martillo. And so, here they were, and in Catalan, that would be, oath would be fals. And this, of course, the song, bon cop de fals, bon cop de fals, right, a good blow from the sickle. Meaning that where there is bad government, there is a right to rise up against that government, right? An uprising, sublevación. And so, the insurrectionists started to attack royal officials, attack anybody who wasn't Catalan. The viceroy was only able to save his life by running away. At least temporarily. He was caught and he was killed. At that point, the government of Catalunya, the Generalitat, offered Catalunya to the King of France. And for a generation, at least theoretically, France was in charge. France didn't really appreciate what the Generalitat was offering, and or never really believed that a French Catalunya would actually have a future. And as I say, after a generation, Catalunya became Spanish, but they were out of the picture, as I say, for what, many, many years. in order to put down the uprising in Catalonia, Olivares ordered Portugal to send troops. And for Portugal, this was the last straw. There had been all sorts of talk about using the Duke of Braganza as a new king. And this is what happened. They proclaimed Juan Cuarto, John the Fourth, as king of Portugal. And Portugal broke away. And its empire broke away. Things were up in the air for both Portugal and for Catalonia, as I say, for an entire generation. Castile did not want to recognize what had happened. Now, obviously, this set a very, very bad precedent. There were people like the Duque de Híjar in Aragon who wanted to emulate Catalonia so that Aragon was suspect as well. Then Naples, Sicily and Naples had all sorts of revolts, right? Just a little bit later, in emulation of all of this. Meanwhile, of course, El Conde Duque de Olivares, yesterday's man, going crazy, little by little, was pushed out of office. But of course, there was nobody really as competent as he was, and things were beginning to fall to pieces. Part of the navy, the navy of the Leeward Islands, right? The Armado de Barlovento joined the French, and threatened to act as corsairs, right? These are Spaniards attacking the Spanish Empire. Meanwhile, in Andalusia, you have the most powerful man in Andalusia, the Duke of Medina Sidonia. Well, Gaspar Pérez de Guzmán, right? His father had died just a few years earlier, and Gaspar became Duke of Medina Sidonia at the age of 33. Young and ambitious, he became the Capitán General de la Mar Oceana y Costas de Andalucía, right? He was the number one military and naval authority in Andalucía, protecting the treasure ships, all of that, the gateway, right, portal, the gateway to the Americas, and North Africa, and, well, with all of that importance, and the man has a sister. His sister, Luisa, happens to be married to the Duque de Braganza, the new king, recently proclaimed king of Portugal. And so, there is an attempt in Andalusia to also break free. Now, I can't imagine what would have happened if this attempt had been successful. Think about it. What if Gaspar Alonso Pérez de Guzmán y Sandoval had actually been able to salirse con la suya, right? To get away with it. Would a possible union of Portugal and Andalusia? Remember that Seville at that time was the most dynamic city in Europe. With the Casa de Contrataciones, with an enormous foreign presence. What would have happened? And it's a good thing for Castile that they could rely on this supply of American silver. Except that they couldn't. All right. Nuestra Señora de la Pura y Limpia Concepción was a ship. It was designed as a nao, all right, very specific kind of ship in La Habana. It was built in Cuba. However, back in Spain, it was refitted, it was reconstructed, reworked as a galleon. It had been built as a merchant ship, and later they reinforced it and they put on 40 cannon, right? 40 bronze cannon. Now, in 1641, she sailed from Cadiz as one of the main ships in the convoy of the fleet bound for Nueva España, bound for what is today Mexico, con destino a, bound for. She carried the new viceroy, the Duke of Escalona, el Virrey, the viceroy, and holy relics. Those relics were considered of fundamental importance. One of the thorns from the crown of Christ and a finger of Saint Andrew. Now, nothing bad happened. They arrived at Veracruz. But while she was at anchor, we often refer to ships as in the female, right? I suppose in modern English, it would only be it. But historically, ships were considered female and are often referred to as female in English. So in this case, I'm going to say she, referring to the Concepción. Now, she arrived at Veracruz. She stayed for 1 year in need of repair. She had not been repaired. She had not been checked. When it was time to go back, she became the flagship. She became the, at the time called the Almiranta, right? The number one ship. And repairs were done badly or not at all. So this is an accident waiting to happen. She carried half the ship, half the treasure of the king, right? The Quinto Real, the 20% of all the silver marked for the king. Well, she was carrying 50% of that. In other words, 10%, or perhaps half of all of the money that is going to the crown for the defense of Spain, the Spanish Empire, which is in one of its most critical moments at this time. Her captain, Juan de Villavicencio, begged. Right, suplico. He begged. He tried to reason. He tried. Come on, repair this ship. My ship is broken. My ship needs repair. Fix my ship. Then we can do this. But no, it's too late. It's already September. You're gonna have to go. His request was denied. No permit for any delay was going to be allowed. Now, as soon as she set out, she began to sink. And they really didn't know what to do. Near Florida, near St. Augustine, there was a tempest, right? The waves reached her they were splashing on the deck through the windows. And, yeah, she was going down. All right, I have to take a break. I'll be back in a minute.
Y hasta aquí el libro English Grammar de Vaughan. Toda la gramática del inglés en un solo libro. Se trata de un libro diseñado para ayudar a hispanohablantes con la gramática del inglés. Encontrarás en él todas las explicaciones gramaticales que necesitas para dominar el idioma y además redactadas de forma sencilla, clara y concisa. Al estar escrito para hispanohablantes, es mucho más sencillo entender cualquier concepto gramatical y esto se nota a lo largo de todo el libro. Además, viene con un código para descargar el audio que acompaña el libro. Entra en vaughantienda.com y hazte con él. English Grammar, de Vaughan. Pásate a vernos a la tienda de Vaughan. Sí, ya está abierta. Ven y nosotros te asesoraremos con el material que te puede ayudar a mejorar tu inglés. Con libros especializados en speaking, listening, grammar, vocabulary. Si quieres, te podemos hacer directamente un plan de estudio para que lo puedas hacer en tu casa. Y mejorar esas pequeñas cositas del inglés que tanto te cuestan con los mejores libros de enseñanza de inglés del mercado. No, no exageramos. Tenemos los mejores libros. Ven a comprobarlo a la tienda de Vaughan. Estamos en Madrid, en la calle Orense 75, esquina con Sor Ángela de la Cruz. De lunes a jueves de 10 a 6 y media y los viernes hasta las 5 y media. Y si vives fuera de Madrid o prefieres contactar con nosotros por teléfono, llámanos al 91-444-5844. La tienda Vaughan. Te asesoramos en lo que necesites.
Young people in Spain speak and understand English better today than 20 years ago. However, their level is still insufficient for effective communication in the professional world. If you're a young person, and if you want to progress in your profession rapidly and decisively, stop everything and focus now 100% on English. Get the problem 100% out of the way now. Don't postpone it.
Sí, dígame.
Hi, Pedro, this is Siobhan, your Vaughan teacher. Welcome to your telephone class.
Oh, hello, Siobhan. How are you doing today?
I'm great. So let's begin by reviewing the present perfect. Have you ever been to China?
No, I haven't.
¿No tienes tiempo de ir a clase? ¿Quieres que tu profesor Vaughan te dé clases por teléfono cuando mejor te venga? Entonces te va a gustar mucho nuestro nuevo programa de clases telefónicas de Vaughan. Infórmate ya en el 91-133-5833 o en grupovaughan.com.
Hey, have you heard about our trimestrales? No? Well, let me tell you all about them. The program lasts 3 months. Eso es, dura 3 meses. Many different timetables to choose from Monday to Friday, Saturdays in the morning. And you'll have plenty of homework. And your teacher will correct your homework and check it to make sure you're making progress. Find out more now. Our trimestrales at Vaughan. Small groups, only 4 to 6 students per class. And the class is focused on speaking and using the language. Contact us and find out about trimestrales with one of our dynamic Vaughan teachers. You won't regret it. No te arrepentirás. More information at grupovaughan.com.
Hello there, this is Fitz. I want to talk to you about the Curso de Inglés Online de Vaughan. €99 for 1 year of classes. You can spread the €99 over 3 months. It's 30 cents per day. All the Vaughan favourites are in there. Richard Vaughan, Richard Brown, Jimena Holiday, Kyle Miller, Alberto Alonso. Curso de Inglés Online, Vaughan.com.
Welcome back. This is Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was talking about the terrible, terrible decade of the 1640s and what that meant to Spain. You know, the beginning of the end, the eclipse. There are historians who point to other factors and say that, you know, something else, but this was one disaster too many. I talked about the year 1640, where simultaneously pretty much Spain lost Catalonia and Portugal, recovering Catalonia, but not Portugal, a generation later. And how this began a sort of cascade effect in which, emulation, copycat activity in Sicily, in Naples, in Aragon, and how Spain was almost at risk of losing Andalusia itself, right? El Duque de Medina Sidonia was prepared to commit treason, and how this would have been, habría sido, this would have been a game changer for the history of Spain. As it was, Spain survived, but not well. And perhaps a dynamic leader would have been able to turn things around. But Felipe IV was not dynamic, and he left everything in the hands of his son, Carlos, El Hechizado, which meant that Spain was run by palace conspiracies, basically, by cabals and cliques of little groups of people conspiring against each other. You know, what people were saying and doing inside the palace was much more important, was high priority, much higher priority than what was going on in the larger world. Nobody could take that big picture. And this, of course, continued until El Hechizado, until the bewitched Charles II, until he died, and a dynastic war began as to whether the Habsburg family or the Bourbon family would take over. Now, in this, as I say, Spain's ability to handle itself, Spain's ability to do things right, depends largely on silver. Not so much gold, but silver. Silver from the Americas. And that silver was coming, but then you see an accident waiting to happen. A completely predictable and completely preventable disaster. Maybe you say that, you know, with such chapuceria, right? With such sloppiness that maybe Spain deserves what it got, right? Se lo merece. Because it was so clear. It was so clear to the captain himself that this voyage was predestined to absolute disaster, By the way, when something is predestined, when you know it is going to fail, the word we use is doom. D-O-O-M. Doom. You might have heard this word before. It's used everywhere. It's used in comics. It's used in cartoons. It's used in video games. Doom. We like this word. And it is, originally, of course, it meant, como contabilidad, right? Las cuentas. And, that was the original meaning, no longer. But de ahí el día del juicio final, doomsday, right? Because that's when there is going to be an accounting, and everybody will have to account for themselves, and there will be a final calculation about whether people go to heaven or hell. Now, that's the second coming. That is doomsday in English. And so, metaphorically, doom has been used to anything that is, anything that has no chance of survival, no hope. We are doomed, or this is your doom. And so, it's a very dramatic word. And so we love it, and we use it in fiction. A lot in fiction. Dr. Doom. Okay, Doom. D-O-O-M. Okay. The Concepcion was doomed from the beginning, and the captain knew that. And they say that off the coast of Florida, in the middle of the storm, the statue of the Virgin Mary, which was attached to the La Popa, right, the aft, the deck, got lost at sea. It separated from the ship, got lost at sea, and so everybody knew at that point that they were doomed. The masts, right, the mastiles, the main and foremast were broken. Boats, anchors, people were all overboard and lost at sea. The fleet broke up and three ships sank. Now, the Concepcion was still afloat, and they tried to improvise a sail to be able to navigate. They didn't know where they were, but they went toward the south. They wanted Puerto Rico or the Bahamas. But what they got was the island of La Española, right? We call it Hispaniola with an H. The island of Hispaniola, which is surrounded by reefs, very bad reefs, about 100 kilometers from Hispaniola, the bottom of the ship hit a reef and began to sink. Now, this area, of course, covered in coral, and Beavicencio, the head, the vice admiral, the man who had predicted that all of this was going to happen in the first place. He was saved. A number of the officers were saved. People were left on board. As the ship was evacuated, people were left on board trying to remove the treasure. There were survivors taken to Hispaniola, to Santo Domingo. The rest of the people on board, again, they were there as long as they could be. The ship, little by little, began to go down, disappear from the water, and about 200 out of the 530 people on board were lost in this disaster. But perhaps more importantly, in the big picture, this money that was supposed to come to Spain in its moment of crisis was lost. Naturally, Spain was deeply in debt at this time. The families, the big German families, you know, because of the 30 Years' War, the big German families, like the Fugars, right, they were out of the picture at this point. However, the Genoveses, the Genoese bankers, were still very much there, and they were waiting and waiting for that money to come in. A lot of the silver was transshipped into Genoese boats the minute it came into port. But still, that money was absolutely essential for Spain's credit and for the credit of everybody living there, right? Everybody living on credit until that money was able to bring liquidity into the economy. Without that money, without that silver, you have a kind of domino effect. Bankruptcy, and disaster. And no money for an army. No money to save Castile, right, from losing Portugal, losing the Portuguese Empire. And perhaps equally important, in financial terms, losing the Portuguese bankers, because those bankers were really important. Spain could not afford, right, permitirse el lujo. Spain could not afford to prescindir, to do without Portuguese bankers. But yes, they went away. And the result was that the very first country to emit a public debt, which was Spain. Spain was the very first country to become, you know, publicly indebted, financed by people outside the country. It also became the very first country to fail and go bankrupt. So yes, there were bankruptcies in 1647, 1652, and 1662. Right? Because one bankruptcy causes another. And as I say, there is a cascade effect. Any sort of collapse works out like una onda expansiva, right? Like a blast wave. And so we have this perfectly avoidable mistake. All right. One person's loss is another person's gain. Right? Every dark cloud has a silver lining. No, mal que por bien no venga, something like that, right? Every dark cloud está forrado de plata, has a silver lining. William Phipps. Let me tell you about William Phipps. William Phipps was born in what is today Maine, as part of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. I've spoken to you about this before. This was the Puritan establishment in North America, the Puritan colony in North America, there with their own charter and their own way of doing things, right? Not willing to be English. English for them was corrupt. The English were corrupt. They didn't want, they wanted to start a new theocratic life. So yes, very, very strict. A child of the New World. He was a shepherd, a pastor, as a boy. And as I mentioned earlier, yeah, tall, heavy, good-looking, and the kind of person everybody likes, right? An American success story. Now, from terrible, terrible poverty in his youth and being an orphan from an early age, his father died when he was 6 years old. We have a biography that says that he was one of 26 children. Now, that's probably an exaggeration. His mother had 6 children with his father and 8 children after she remarried. 14 is quite enough. Back then, when any childbirth, right, cualquier parto, any delivery, that was risking your life. So, yes. Naturally, when you are a member of a big family like that, you need to get out and make your own way in life as soon as you possibly can. You do not want to be a burden, lastre. You do not want to be a burden to your family. You want to be an asset, activo. And so, as soon as he possibly could, he found an apprenticeship. And he became an apprentice builder, carpenter, ship's carpenter. In this time, he was not ever schooled. People imagine that he couldn't read and write, and that his numbers, his arithmetic, right, his capacity at maths was also limited. Although, as a ship's carpenter, right, somebody who makes boats, you would need these kind of practical skills. Still, not educated. As I mentioned at the beginning of this program, he is going to become rich and famous. And he's going to be the first North American ever to be a Sir. Sir William Phipps. That's much later. And when he does, he's not going to write his own letters. Right? He will have scribes, and he will have a personal secretary, and he will hire people to do these things for him, because without education, he is incapable of doing them for himself. But at that time, this was quite common. You know, maybe we don't consider it normal, but it was common. And when he was 22 years old and his apprenticeship was over, he went to Boston. Remember that he was from the fringes, from the periphery of the colony. And so Boston, the center of the colony, must have seemed like a big place for him. He worked as a ship's carpenter in Boston, and there he married Mary Spencer Hull. Now, Mary's father was a merchant. It's possible, you know, that they knew each other through business deals or something like that. But this was his lucky break. Now, by the way, this is just an aside, just a digression. You're going to see this man nobody's really sure how he did it. Everybody was how, you know, impressed they were. Everybody comments on how impressed they were by his physical presence and, how attractive he was, how seductive he was, how, and this, probably, you know, a pretty face will get you, will open many doors. And so, because in the course of this story, he's going to be in England, he's going to be in the Caribbean, he's going to be gone for a long, long time. And there were times when he did not see his wife for 5 years, did not see his wife for 8 years. However, there's no scandal. Nobody ever said anything. He was supposed to have been the model of marital fidelity. So he marries this girl at age 22. And at the end of his life, comes back to her. And they live happily ever after. And so if this sounds like Cuento de Hadas, if this sounds like a fairy tale, well, sometimes fairy tales are true. In any case, so here he is. He established his own shipyard, right? This is a, well, the fact is, in Spanish, I'm not sure when you should say dársena, and when you should say astillero, because astillero sounds modern, and dársena sounds medieval. These ships were made of wood, and there was plenty, plenty, plenty of wood in New England. And, well, he was doing well. The shipyard was very successful, and ended up building, you know, bigger and bigger ships. They started small and went big. And when he had the great ship, a very, very big ship, and he was all ready for its maiden voyage, for its very first voyage, it was filled with all sorts of goods that he was going to take and make a great profit. This was during the moment in King Philip's War, a war with, there were hostile natives, and the Indians began to attack. And so the entire town got on, this is where the shipyard, the astillero, was located. The entire town got on board his ship, and he took as many of the locals as he could. The Indians destroyed his shipyard, destroyed the cargo, and ruined him. However, by the locals, he was considered a hero, the man who could do no wrong. And we will see what this reputation does for him, because everybody loves him. We will see what this reputation does for him when he comes back from England and he has to impose English law on the Massachusetts colony. So yeah, things are going to change very quickly. But yes, at the beginning, everybody loves Phipps. Now, sailors talk, right? Sailors gossip. Nothing is secret. Sailors get drunk and they talk, and that's just it. Stories of treasure. Stories of sunken treasure. Stories of where Phipps might be able to find the treasure of the Concepcion. this treasure that had been lost, 40 years earlier, and was still under the water somewhere. Now, Phipps knew about this, and it was just a question of what he was going to do with this information. He really didn't have enough money to do this kind of operation on his own. He was going to need financing from London. And so he went to London. But I seem to have run out of time. I'll have to talk about that on my next program.
Trivia Nights. You can practice your English, test your knowledge, and have a blast with your favorite Vaughn Radio hosts. It's going to take place at Roll Madrid, Calle Amaniel 23. And the date is Wednesday, February 2nd at 8:30 p.m. Come, join the fun at Vaughn Radio's Trivia Nights at Roll Madrid, Calle Amaniel 23. We'll see you there. Hosted by